Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. Emails and Zoom meetings, video chats with friends and family, streaming movies, ordering groceries online. For many of us, the burdens of the pandemic have been eased by the internet. But a new report by the nonprofit Able Foundation makes clear that reliable access to the World Wide Web is a privilege. About 40% of Baltimore households go without internet access, and one out of three families does not have either a laptop or desktop computer. Baltimore City recently tapped $3 million from its Children and Youth Fund in order to connect more students to distance learning with devices and internet. City schools have been distributing thousands of Chromebooks to students over the past few weeks. Later in the program, we'll hear how the lack of technology access is affecting students. First, let's meet John Horrigan, a senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute and senior advisor to the Urban Libraries Council. He was also research director for the National Broadband Plan at the Federal Communications Commission. Horrigan is the author of the recent Able Foundation report, Baltimore's Digital Divide: Gaps in Internet Connectivity and the Impact on Low-Income City Residents. John Horrigan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
What problems does the lack of internet and device access cause?
For students, if you're reliant on either no internet connection at home or only a smartphone, you're at a definite disadvantage relative to students who have a wireline broadband connection, such as cable or fiber optic, and students who don't have, or students who have a computer, either desktop or laptop. So if you're a student in a household relying only on a smartphone, research shows you're less likely to complete your homework, you're less likely to have the digital skills you need to get through your curriculum. So not having that home wireline connection, not having computers with sizable screens are real consequential in a negative way for students.
Amplify that for me. I mean, is it primarily the size of the screen, the small screen on a phone, that limits how valuable it is as a learning tool?
That's part of it. Also, just the limited size of the keyboard to input content. I mean, a lot of what schoolwork is not just downloading content like many of us are used to doing, whether we're streaming something or reading news online. It's about, if you're a student, creating content, completing a report, or doing those sorts of things. And if you're doing that with a teeny keyboard on a smartphone, it's just really difficult to get that done.
How does the lack of internet and computer access in Baltimore compare to other cities?
Baltimore does not compare well to other cities. In the report I did for Able, we took a sample of 33 cities in total around the country, some larger than Baltimore, some smaller than Baltimore, some wealthier, some not as wealthy, others with a core of tech industry and others not so much into the tech industry. And Baltimore ranked 29th out of 33 for home wireline broadband adoption and 30 out of 33 for having a desktop or laptop computer in the home. So Baltimore doesn't rate well when you look at other cities. And in the report, we looked at trends extending back several years. Baltimore is also not closing the gap relative to other cities. So Baltimore has work to do.
In your report, you use the phrase wireline subscription rate. What does that refer to?
It means whether you have a cable subscription to the internet, a DSL subscription, or a fiber optic subscription. And so it refers to the kinds of internet connections that are the most robust for streaming content or getting homework assignments, for instance. Now, a key difference between internet access on a smartphone plan versus a wireline subscription plan is the amount of data you can consume in a given month. If you have a wireline broadband plan, you have data caps that are so high that people don't even know they have them. People who have cable broadband subscriptions typically use about 250 gigabytes of data per month. On smartphone plans, data caps usually are on the order of 50 gigabytes per month, And that's not enough for doing homework. And that's because research shows that households with students in them who rely on either smartphones or hotspots, which are also on data plans, typically use about 70 gigabytes of data per month. So the smartphone is a constraint not only because of the small screen and keyboard, but also because of the amount of data you're able to use in a given month.
And as you mentioned, in Baltimore, the home wireline subscription rate increased by less than 1% between 2016 and 2018. Why has the needle barely moved?
Most often, people are citing the monthly cost of an internet subscription. Oftentimes, they also cite the cost of a computing device to access the internet. So it's an affordability issue for low-income households in particular.
This is On the Record on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with technology expert John Horrigan, author of a new report on Baltimore's digital divide. The gaps in internet and device access are even more pronounced when you look across income levels. Talk about that.
Yeah, well, we did take a focus on households with school-age children, and we found that of households in Baltimore City that have school-age children and did not have wireline broadband subscriptions, 80% of them were in the lowest income category. So you have portions of Baltimore City, neighborhoods with high concentrations of low-income households, and in a lot of instances, just a third of them have a wireline broadband subscription, and about the same number have a computer. So they're really existing in broadband deserts simply because service is out of reach for so many of these households.
And you found striking disparities when you compared African-American and Hispanic households to white households.
That's right. For that metric that I've been talking about, the home wireline broadband subscription, over three-quarters of white households have a subscription of that sort, whereas roughly in the range of 50% of African-American and 50% of Hispanic households have wireline broadband subscriptions. So the gaps are very evident across categories of race and ethnicity. Now, a lot of those households who are African-American or Latino do have smartphones for access, so they're not completely cut off from the internet, but they lack, again, the key tool for doing things online these days, a wireline subscription, as well as a computing device.
There are some existing options for low-income families to get connected. Describe what's available.
Well, in the city, there is the Comcast Internet Essentials plan. Comcast does serve Baltimore City, or at least most places in Baltimore City. And Internet Essentials gives low-income households the opportunity to subscribe to a $10 per month internet plan with 25 megabit download speeds. So that's a fairly good subscription plan. Given the pandemic, Comcast is offering a free 60-day offer for people deciding now to subscribe to Internet Essentials. And after that 60-day period, they go to the $10 per month plan. We see also in Baltimore City little islands of mesh networks, which is to say broadband networks that cover usually a block or two of the city, but they're going up in low-income neighborhoods, and they give people a chance to subscribe to a fixed wireless broadband service for little or no cost. So that's another option that's springing up as well. Comcast has greater coverage than mesh networks, but the mesh networks sometimes are free to access for households.
If Baltimore really bridged the gap, what would be the impact?
I mean, the impact would be to get not only more kids connected to educational resources, but there's another part of the problem that we haven't touched on yet, which is healthcare and telehealth. In the pandemic, you have people not able to go to the doctor, but you have many people taking advantage of the internet to get online with a doctor via telehealth applications to help cope with a healthcare issue. Baltimore has its share of public health issues in low-income neighborhoods in particular, So if you could start to get more people online, start to get them the training on how to use the internet, you could see positive impacts in educational outcomes as well as health outcomes.
I really appreciate your summarizing your research for us. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
John Horrigan, a senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute and senior advisor to the Urban Libraries Council, wrote about Baltimore's digital divide for the Able Foundation. We have a link to the report at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. Quick break, and then a teacher and a parent advocate talk about problem solving the challenges of distance learning. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us on the record.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. While students aren't physically attending school, the school year isn't quite out yet, and we don't yet know if schools will continue distance learning in the fall or to what extent. What is clear is that low-income students are less likely to have the internet or a computer at home. A new report by the Able Foundation documents what researchers call the homework gap. More than 38,000 children in Baltimore City in homes without broadband. For them, distance learning consists of printed work packets and lessons on public access television. Rebecca Yenowin is executive director of the Teachers Democracy Project, a parent-led education and advocacy organization. Rebecca, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Franca Muller-Paz is a Spanish teacher at Baltimore City College and the faculty advisor of SOMOS, Students Organizing a Multicultural and Open Society. Franca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Rebecca, what are you hearing from parents?
I'm hearing a lot of frustration and isolation right now. I think I got a call at 7:30 this morning from a parent who had no computer for her child who has some special needs, as well as a daughter who's in general education. And she was not sure that what she was able to do with her kids with the packets that she has was enough. And without that way to be connected to a teacher to guide and reassure the parent, as well as keep children on track, it's just really frustrating. And I think the parent was also dealing with a loss. Her mom had just passed away. Mm. So I think all of those things combined just create a really stressful, hard space for families.
Franca, how are you connecting with your students these days?
Well, we're doing online learning, so that looks like classes via Google Meet. Other teachers are using Blackboard Collaborate and different applications like that. But I find that it's actually been really hard to communicate with students, and I know a lot of teachers feel the same way. We have students that during the year are never absent, would never miss a day. And some of those students I haven't heard from in weeks. I haven't heard from since this happened. And so it's a really big concern how hard it has been to be able to get in touch with all of these students. And I think that has, you know, enormous repercussions. Teachers were mandated reporters when it comes to things like abuse and things. We're not seeing those students, so obviously reports are down. It doesn't mean that abuse and things isn't happening. Students that really counted on school as a safe place, you know, they've had that sort of pulled out from under them, and I know it's been really difficult for students to get through this time.
Tell me more about what challenges they're facing, your students are facing in keeping up with schoolwork and exams.
Yeah, well, one of the things is lack of device access. So even though, you know, the school district has been working hard to get devices into the hands of students, schools across the city, any piece of technology that they can put in the hand of a student is leaving the school and it's going to families directly. The school system has purchased 12,200 devices for families. But even then, you know, that's maybe one device per household. When there are perhaps two, three, four students in that household trying to share and work off of the same device. And so that's one big issue where students are having to ration the use amongst each other and their siblings and cousins that they live with to be able to type their essays and do their work. And then on top of that, there is the issue of the actual internet access. And so when everyone is being forced to be at home, their parents and family members, you know, adult family members included, and we have things like Comcast Internet Essential Package, which is meant to be a package to support low-income families, those bandwidths are so low that they really can't sustain more than a couple of people being online at the same time. And so, again, families are having to ration what times during the day they're able to be online. So that's hugely problematic for students to be able to get their work done. And as one of my students recently put it, she says, you know, we have a choice to make every day. Is my parent going to go to work online and do the things that they need to do to get their job that's going to get food on our table? Or do I get to do my assignments? And that's the choice that families are having to go through.
Rebecca, the Teachers Democracy Project has been working to collect and distribute devices and chargers. How many devices have you distributed?
We've distributed about 150 devices, tablets, laptops, desktops, and some phones, which we know are not ideal. But if we find a family that has five children, we try to put, you know, a laptop, a tablet, and some phones, or, you know, some array of devices in that family's hands so that they can, you know, rotate and meet their needs.
Tell us more about the families that you're distributing devices to.
We have about 360 folks that have reached out. I think that is a small fraction of the need. There's a wide range. I mean, there are families that are working families. There are families where there may be one parent that's able to stay home. There's some people that are having to go to work and figure out what their kids are doing while they're going to work, leaning on other family members. There's a wide range of folks that are in need.
Are you still collecting devices?
We are still collecting primarily now that the district has a bunch of new technology and have given out the technology that they had in their school buildings. We've been focusing on families that have more than one student in the household, and as well as charter schools. Some of them do not have the funds to purchase their own laptops for their students, and the district isn't providing laptops to those schools, so we're figuring out where we can be most useful in augmenting what the district is doing.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Rebecca Yenowin of the Teachers Democracy Project and Franca Mueller-Paz, a Spanish teacher at Baltimore City College, about the consequences of meager internet access for Baltimore students, teachers, and families. Franca, what are you hearing from other teachers?
Teachers are definitely really concerned. They're concerned about what's happening with students, being able to get in touch with them, and also the continuity of learning. A lot of teachers also, we just got through a week of AP testing recently. So I know a lot of students at Baltimore City College High School were still needing to take their AP exams, and they went on despite the fact that we're in this crisis with coronavirus. And so we tried to work together, and this is something I know a lot of teachers are working on, of just trying to help make sure that students have the devices they need to be successful. So, but unfortunately, the reality is that across the United States, some students got to take AP exams on a MacBook Pro with, you know, 200 megabits of data and speeds on their internet, and other students we know had to take that exam on their phones, a timed exam. So teachers are trying to fill in the gaps as much as possible, but I think, you know, we definitely feel like we're in a situation where we have both arms sort of tied behind our back to make the kind of changes that we know that students need and that they need to be successful.
Rebecca, what are teachers telling you?
And teachers are telling me that online education is really hard, and that they're able to do only a fraction of what they're able to do normally in the classroom. I'm also hearing how important it is to just connect with young folks. You know, you have no idea what's going on in young people's families. One success story that I've heard is that there's from a teacher who has a lot of special education students, that the calls that, you know, what he does is he reaches out to 5 students per day and has a phone call. And so this one-on-one time that he's able to get with students is different than what normally happens in the classroom. And so if there is one thing to take away from this that is positive, is that from these one-on-one interactions with students that normally struggle quite a bit in a group situation, they've been able to grow and really move forward on some things that have historically been pretty difficult. So, you know, I've been trying to look for silver linings in a otherwise pretty hard situation where I think learning is just not adequate.
Franca, you are the faculty advisor to the group SOMOS, Students Organizing a Multicultural and Open Society. How are they working to address the digital divide?
Well, first, they were working with a coalition of many organizations called the Digital Equity Coalition and also Digital Equity Advocates to push on City Hall to do their part. And so we were, you know, really excited that $3 million could go towards helping to close the digital divide and also to help establish community internet networks through mesh technology that is starting at 4 different pilot schools around the city in locations that are concentrations of low internet access and connection, and of course correlates with also being the parts of our city that are more Black and brown. The next phase of what students are working on now is asking for corporations and internet service providers to also help uphold their end. So they are, they have released a letter of demands for Comcast asking 3 really specific things. They want first to increase the download and upload speeds that can actually allow for distance learning to take place. The second request is to have internet essentials. Right now, it's a package that lasts for 2 months once you sign up. They are asking that once someone enrolls, that they remain enrolled in the free aspect of the program until the 60 days after the full resumption of school. And finally, they also want Comcast to open up all of their hotspots so that immediately students and families that are living in denser parts of the city can access that hotspot internet. And this letter with their list of demands, they're planning on presenting tomorrow.
Rebecca, a final thought?
I feel like the crisis of being in a pandemic has lifted up an issue that's always been there. The digital divide was an issue before now, but it has become even more clear how much internet access is a human right and that we need to think of it that way. And we need to use this time to create a really long-term strategy. We need to come up with how to create municipal broadband for our city. And I think there's a couple emerging technologies that are worth exploring. One is called the mesh network, but we can't think that we're going to go back to some normal and that this issue will go away. We have to actually fix it.
Thank you both for this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Rebecca Yenowin is executive director of the Teachers Democracy Project. Franca Mueller-Paz is a Spanish teacher at Baltimore City College. We've got links with more information at the On the Record page at WYPR.org. This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cass. Glad you're listening. Join us again tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Cast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.